Hi there. So this week, this episode is going out on Mother's Day here in Ireland. And so as we mark Mother's Day, I think, of course, of my own sister, Elaine, who was a young mom to two small children when she passed away. You know, I know how painful and heavy this day can feel for so many. And I also would like to dedicate this episode to my dear friend, Trish, who is facing her first Mother's Day without her beloved son, Harry. My heart is with her and with everyone who finds today difficult. Mothers grieving the loss of a child, children without their moms, those struggling with infertility, those longing for a child that they never got to hold, those who have lost a mother figure, and those with complicated or estranged relationships. However you're feeling today, please know that you are not alone. This episode is proudly sponsored by Love Cherish, a beautiful boutique based in Charleville, County Cork, and online at lovecherish.com. Love Cherish isn't just about fashion, it's about confidence, joy, and feeling your best in what you wear. Whether you're looking for something special or just a little pick-me-up, they have the perfect pieces to brighten your day. And don't forget, as a thank you, you can use the discount code FLOWERS10, that's the number 10, for a special discount when you shop with them. A huge thank you to Love Cherish for their support in bringing this podcast to you guys. It truly makes a difference. This week, on a very special Mother's Day episode, I sit down with Nicola Maguire as she shares the story of her incredible parents, Pam and Vinnie. Both were diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and as their only child, Nicola devoted her life to caring for them. She speaks about the deep love between her parents, the heartbreak of watching her mom fade away, and the anticipatory grief she now carries for her dad. It's a conversation about love, loss, and the unbreakable bond between a mother and child. And as always, if you find this episode helpful, please consider following the podcast, sharing it on social media, or sending it to someone who might need to hear it. It really does help the podcast to grow, which is what we want to do to reach more people. Here's the episode. I hope you enjoy it. So I'm here with Nicola. Hi, Nicola. How are you?
Hi, Cathy. I'm good. Thank you.
Good to see you.
And you too.
So you have travelled from Dublin.
I have.
Today.
Yes.
To be with me. And we're going to have a chat today about, as always, what this podcast is about is grief, love, loss, relationships, the connection. And loss, I suppose, is very varied. It can happen in lots of different ways and show in different ways. So I suppose today we're going to chat about your parents. And so what I would love to do is, first of all, hear all about them. And their names were Pam and Vinnie.
Yes.
So would you tell me about them a little bit?
Of course, I'd love to. Yeah, I love talking about them. So my dad had been a professional footballer for all his life. When he gave that up, he started to do taxiing. They were set up on a date and he stood her up on the first date. So she was like, well, feck this now.
Yeah.
That fella's, you know, done. But he tried again and they met up and it was pretty much love at first sight.
Okay.
Very good. And they were together for 3.5 years, I think it was, before they got married. Children weren't on the cards, they were told. And
right.
Then lo and behold, I arrived. Apparently there was great excitement. My nanny used to live with us, so there was great excitement that Pam had, you know, because they thought she wouldn't have a child. So there was great excitement.
You were the only child?
I'm the only child. Yeah. So just me. So
growing up, what was it like?
Dad was the easier one to get around.
Okay.
Right. So poor Mam had to play bad cop, which wasn't fair, but I chanced my arm because I was like, look, might as well just chance with one of them. But they never wanted me to be a spoiled only child. So that was instilled from me from a very young age. And I think people have this assumption that as an only child, you get everything. That was not the case with me. Like it was, you have to work, you have to do X, Y, and Z to get this particular thing. So yeah, growing up, like in teenage years, I suppose Mam and I would have had our mother-daughter clashing kind of moments. But we always came back around. Like, you know, I'd go to Mam. We spoke about everything. There was nothing I couldn't talk to Mam about, which was brilliant, and vice versa. Like, we opened up, I moved back to the area that we're from. I was living kind of closer to city centre, and I moved back, and she'd come up, say, on a Thursday or Friday evening, and we'd have a few glasses of wine, and we just used to have so much crack. I was thinking about it on the drive down today, like some of the stories she told me, like just about her growing up, stuff that I wouldn't have heard. It was just lovely to hear. I've such lovely memories of us sitting on the couch, just having a laugh and having a bit of crack. Like, and myself and Dad were very close. I was always a dad's girl in a sense, but I think I was a 50-50, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like, I was in between. I had great relationships, but different relationships with the two of them. Like, I'd go to Dad about anything as well. But I suppose on a deeper level, Mam and I would have very deep conversations, yeah. You know.
The female thing.
Yes. Yeah.
So I suppose, where then or when did your story with them change in terms of, when did you first notice anything wrong with either of them?
So I suppose with Dad, I noticed it back, oh, you're talking about 10 years ago. Mm. I noticed little things, but nothing major, you know, nothing that you'd kind of would stop you in your tracks. Mm. Just little things. Like, he was never particularly good at, you know, remembering birthdays or, you know, date. Mam was the one, she was the organizer, so organized, like from a financial perspective, anything that needed to be done at home in that sense, Mam was the one, and she was meticulous in what she did. Mm-hmm. Because that was her background from a work perspective. So with Dad, I just started to notice little things. And then with Mam, it started to happen a little bit quicker. I started to notice bigger things, like, you know, she might forget the PIN on her bank card, and we'd be thinking of ways to, you know, how do we remember this or whatever, and then she'd lose her bank card, that kind of thing. And then, you know, with Alzheimer's, what happens is their perception of reality versus your perception of reality are two different things. I remember one day, it was one Saturday, and I called down and I was sitting at the kitchen table on my laptop. I was working, and she used to make this casserole for them at the weekend. It was kind of pretty much every weekend she'd make it. So we were yapping away, I was working away, and she was, you know, chopping up the veg and doing all her bits. And I mean, this is something she'd done thousands of times before. And I was just aware of her, because I never wanted to say it, like, are you okay? Or is there something wrong? Because it's very hard to bring it up or mm-hmm. start the conversation. But I remember just being aware of her, kind of, you know, she chopped the onions and then she'd be kind of looking around, and I could see her having to second guess herself all the time. And then she burst into tears. And I said, Mam, what's wrong? And she said, I can't remember how to make this. Mm. And I said, that's okay. I said, it's all right. Like, we'll figure out this. Will we do it together? And she said, I should be able to do this. Like, I should know what I'm doing. And I said, you're just tired. Maybe you didn't have a good sleep. Like, you know, you're trying to. Now, inside my stomach was doing somersaults, because I was like, oh God. Are we facing this? Because it was both of my parents' worst fears. They said, give me anything, but don't give me Alzheimer's. So I suppose that was the big one for me. Then I remember with Mam, say certain things would happen with money. Money is a big thing with Alzheimer's, that you're afraid that you're going to lose all your money. So what Mam would do is she'd take out money, but then she wouldn't remember where it was. And then, you know, she might say, did you take that money on me? And I'd say, no, I didn't touch your, you know, I didn't touch your money, because it's a fear that comes over them. And I could see that fear coming over Mam very, very quickly. I suppose if you can imagine it yourself, you're out of control of who you are, trying to do the things that she did every single day. And all of a sudden they were becoming really difficult to do. Things, I suppose, started to happen. Even her sense of the way she dressed changed a little bit. Mm. You know, as I said, she was real into her glam, and she always looked gorgeous. But the way she dressed change, little things where you'd be like, she'd always say to me, you know, if I was in the house, what's this like? And I'd always, because it was always lovely, I'd say, that's gorgeous. And then a couple of times my dad actually said to her, Pam, you can't wear that.
It wasn't making sense.
It just wasn't, you know, pairing things together, which she was so good at because she was so into fashion. She wasn't looking the way she used to.
Yeah, yeah. I get that, yeah.
Do you know, so we had an appointment, I suppose it was the diagnosis with the team. We had a great team over in Tala that Dad would have been under. And obviously she was defensive because you don't want your worst fear to become reality. Like, so I completely got that. So we were back and forth a little bit. And what you're asked to do in these, I can only imagine, because if someone says to you, you know, write the word apple, I'd sit here and I'd write it, no problem. But if you're being watched, you know, and someone is actually, you know, it's like an exam almost, you get flustered. And with Alzheimer's, you know, some people, and my mom, one of her biggest side effects would have been anxiety, which she would have suffered with previous to having the disease. So all these tests didn't go her way because she was nervous and she was anxious and she was like, people are watching me, and if I don't get it right, they're going to think I'm stupid. And we'd have these chats before we went in, and I'd say, Mom, they're not going to think you're stupid. This is not to try and catch you out. This is just trying to give you back the quality of life that you deserve to have. Like, you deserve to have a good quality of life, no matter what the outcome is.
So the GP was the first port of call for you guys?
Yes. So we went and had a chat with the GP.
And then he referred
Dr. Ashling, and she said, and it was like, what's going on? And we had a conversation, and Mom had said to me, will you do the talking? So I said, if you want me to do the talking, because one thing I never wanted to do was I never wanted to take away the independence, because it's so important, as long as you can, that you keep that going. So I said, if you want me to do it, would you stop me any time that you don't agree or whatever? And she did. Like, you know, she was able to say, well, no, I don't know if that happened or whatever it might be. So we had a chat with Dr. Ashling. We spoke about, you know, the cooking. And at that stage, Mom didn't remember that. And about the money going missing. And she had got to a point there then when she thought that I wasn't giving her tablets. And that wasn't a criticism of me. That was, again,
a belief
and a perception of what was going on. Because the fear, and I think it's something people, well, I never realised it, the fear that comes with certain forms of Alzheimer's it's horrendous. It's so frightening for the person. It's just so, so frightening. So I think that was all a bit of it was all building up and building up. So then Dr. Ashling referred us to Tala Hospital, and that's where we met Professor Kennelly, and he was the one. So then we were under a team called the Integrated Care Team, who were amazing and so helpful throughout everything. Mam was diagnosed in May, I think, of 2018. And I remember coming out of that appointment with Mam, and I said to her, how do you feel? You know, how are you feeling? And she said, about what? And I said, just about the appointment. Like, how do you think it went? Or, you know, the fact that dementia was mentioned. And she said, dementia was mentioned. So again, it's like a wall comes down between what's after happening and their perception of reality.
So was she fairly advanced, I suppose, at that stage, do you believe?
She was really good at, they say that women are better at hiding it than men. So she'd be really good, say, if we were out and we met someone and someone would be walking towards, I say it was you, and she'd say, and you'd say, hi, Pam. And she'd put her head down to me and say, who's this? And I'd say, that's Kathy. Oh, hi, Kathy, how are you? She was very good at doing that and did that for a long time.
So you're coming from your appointment. And now at the same time, when you come home, your dad is starting to show some symptoms, but you have no idea what's going on.
Again, I'm suspicious.
Okay.
I'm suspicious. Tell me why. Because my dad, two of his brothers had it.
Okay.
So where my dad's eldest brother, so my dad lost his own dad when he was 12, which is so young, and his eldest brother kind of took on the fatherly role. So himself and my Uncle John were very close. And when my Uncle John got sick, it had a huge impact on Dad. And it made him question himself. And I remember one day, because I'd always try and go over and meet him, say, on a Sunday morning over where my uncle was. They'd go to Mass together and then I'd meet them after and we'd go for a little walk around, whatever. I suppose it opened up conversations between Dad and myself about the disease, you know, and he'd say, and it still haunts me to this day, this statement, "Don't ever let me get like that. I couldn't handle it." And I was told by one of my dad's nieces only in the last couple of years that, so it was her dad that was ill at the time, that when they were over with my uncle, my dad said to her, "I think I have the same thing." But someone interrupted them. And then my cousin said she didn't want to bring it up again because she didn't want to make him feel uncomfortable. She said, "If he wants to come to me and talk to me, he will," but he never did again.
And what were you noticing, if anything?
Tiny little things. Like, I'd go in and the back door would be open. I suppose the biggest thing that I noticed was, say, the oven being left on. And that's when I started to panic, because I was like, okay, we're kind of getting into dangerous territory here because anything could happen. So yeah, I was back at home and my plan was, because in my head, and in hindsight, it's a very naive way to look at things, but it was a coping mechanism for me. I never thought anything had happened to my parents. I never let myself believe anything would happen because I just couldn't go down that road. Like, myself and one of my best friends would always say to each other, "This and that'll never happen to us. Like, our parents are going to live forever." So I think in my head, even as I grew up, I was like, "They're going to be fine. No matter what happens, like, they're going to be grand." Like, they, you know, that's the way I just kind of dealt with things. Even as diagnosis came, I was like, "It's going to be fine. It's going to be grand." So in my head, I said, "I'm going to stop working for a year, take time out." I was going to do an online course in animal welfare. That was the plan. And that was in 2019. And then skip on to January 2020 and our worlds were turned upside down. We had a house fire that destroyed our home. And that kind of just catapulted everything, because a house fire is just so, it's just such a horrible experience. Like, you know, it's just, it's such a frightening experience. It was so frightening for them. And actually, that's the one thing I was thankful to Alzheimer's for, and I'm not thankful to it for very much, was that they forgot it after. You know, they forgot it after some time.
And they were there and you were there?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So we were very lucky to get out. Very, very lucky.
Did it happen in the middle of the night?
Happened at 20 past nine on a Friday night.
Okay, so you got them out.
Got them out. And then my poor dad went back in. I went back in to get him out, and I lost my two beautiful pets who followed me back in and got into their beds. Yeah. So it was just a horrific, horrific time.
But just to touch on that, I often get messages from people asking me, would you cover the loss of a pet?
Yeah.
Like, there's a huge grief there. So you lost your two pets.
Yeah. So I had a dog and a cat, and we've always been a huge animal family. Always had animals. Like, I don't remember a time where we didn't have pets, and they're a huge part of our life, still a huge part of mine. But it was horrific. It was, my dog was going through cancer treatment at the time. My little cat, Trudy, she had moved back in with me. So Millie, my dog, lived with my parents, but I'd get to see her. She'd come up for sleepovers and everything all the time. She was the best. And she was doing really well on her cancer treatment. Knew the time was ticking, but she was doing very, very well. Like, they were blown away by how well she was doing. But the loss of them, I have to say, because they were my constant. So the loss of them was massive. Yeah. When you have a relationship with an animal, you know, and especially when you're going through things, they're just your constant source of comfort. They can pick up when you're having a bad day. You mightn't be in tears, but they'll know, and they're by your side. And the two of them were like that with me all the time. And they were so good with Mam and Dad. Like, if Mam was having a bad day, Millie was over beside her, just sitting by her side, just aware she's having a bad day. So I'm just going to sit here and be with her. And the same with Trudy. She would like put on this little show for Mom. Wasn't great sleeping at night. So if we got up, Trudy would put on a little show for her, like, you know, with her little balls, playing with the balls. And Mom, she loved that. So it was, yeah, it was horrendous. And, you know, so from there, then we thought that initially the damage to the house wasn't as bad as we thought it was, but it actually turned out that it was worse than we thought it was. But then COVID, it was coming into that time. So all of this is happening at the same time. I'm trying to find accommodation for, with the help of others, for us. And no accommodation suited. Just Mom and Dad with Dad's arthritis and stuff. We lived in a bungalow. And I was very conscious that stairs was going to be a huge upheaval and a huge change. It might sound like something so simple, but it was going to be a huge upheaval. So Mom and Dad, through the help of the integrated care team in Tallaght, went into Mount Carmel, who were fantastic. So they very kindly took, you know, Mom and Dad in. They had the same room. And then things started moving with the house. So it was like, okay, you know, this is, things are moving along. And then, bam, pandemic hits. So with that, it was, we had a very helpful assessor who was working with the house, and everything shut down. You know, it's like we have to stop. So at that point, I was in an apartment, so I was able to go back and forth to Mom and Dad. And thankfully, where their window was right at the door on the way in. It was a big window, so I could talk to them at the window. But I have to say, that was one of the most difficult things, because you can't touch them. You're trying to reassure them that everything's going to be okay. You're trying to, you know, tell them what's going on the outside world, but not tell them too much as to scare them, because they're completely oblivious, because they're in this kind of safe house, if you like. So they don't know what's going on the outside world. So everything stopped with the house. And then we fast forward to March. This time, actually in 2020, they both contracted COVID. Dad was asymptomatic. Mom was really sick. And I got a phone call one day to say, your mom has been taken into intensive care. She's going to James's if you want to head over. So obviously, straight in the car, headed over to James's. Everywhere's like a ghost town. It was the most surreal kind of experience. And I'm waiting, and the, you know, this ambulance, you can't go too close to the door. You have to stand way, way back. And you're asked why you're standing around, because obviously they don't want people standing around. So I said, look, I'm waiting for my mom and I'm not leaving till she gets here. Like, I need to just know. At this stage, I didn't know. Apologies, I should have said this. The results hadn't come back yet, or I hadn't been told about them yet. But Mom took a turn. So as they're opening the ambulance doors, I'm standing there and I can see her, and she just shouts, Nicola. And I said, Mom. And the poor paramedic, I'll never forget his face. He just said, positive. He shouted to the, and then the other guy said, I think that's the daughter. And he said, you didn't know. And I was trying to not convulse at this stage. I was just so upset because I couldn't get to her. She's right in front of me. And I can't even touch her. And I just remember her saying, please don't leave me. And I had to say to her, I'll be in to see you. Like, I'll be in, I'll get in to see you and you'll be okay. And she was a colour that I can't even explain. Like, she was just this grey colour and had the most horrific, horrific cough. She just looked like a different person. She was just so, so sick. And then they took her and they brought her in, and I could hear her saying, because I wasn't allowed to go past a certain line, Nicola, please don't leave me. And at that stage, I broke down. I completely broke down, because like, you're leaving her in a hospital that, you know, doesn't even look like a hospital anymore. It looks, no, you can't see anyone's faces. You know, everyone's in hazmat suits.
A real scary time, because at that stage, we didn't know what on earth COVID was. It was like the plague, like the way it was terrifying towards the start of it, because we didn't really understand. We thought we're all going to be wiped out. That's literally it was like doomsday. This is the media, everything. I suppose as it went on, we understood that it was very serious for some people, not so serious for others. We could live with it. But at that particular moment, it was to hear the words that she's positive must have really rattled you.
It honestly, it was the fact I couldn't get to her.
That
you see your mom right in front of you and she's terrified and you're terrified for her and there's nothing you can do.
And she's dealing with this condition where she's not able maybe to fight for herself.
Yeah,
and she's confused. Heartbreaking.
It was absolutely heartbreaking.
So she spent a bit of time in the hospital, but ultimately she was very ill. She was in intensive care for 3 weeks.
3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. I got a call to say, look, there's nothing else we can do. She's, you know, it's time. You need to get your any messages you want and you need to say goodbye. So I still can't remember the doctor's name. I just remember her name being Dr. Sarah. And I just remember saying to her, I said, please, please, whatever you can do. I said, she's my best friend. I said, please, 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 please don't let her die. And the poor doctor was in tears because I was one of many phone calls that poor doctor had to make that day. And when I think about it now, I wish I knew who she was that I could actually say to her, like, thank you, like, for, and give her a hug just because what they were going through as well. So I went in and James's were so good, you know, because people weren't allowed in, but they knew the situation and full hazmat suit on. And Mam is in this tiny, tiny little room where there's not a sinner in the hospital. Like, there's nobody walking around apart from, say, one or two doctors in full
hazmat
gear. So I went into her and I said, hi, Mam. And I had the glasses and everything. And she said to me, and, you know, she could barely talk. And I said, it's Nico. Nico is what they call me. So I said, it's Nico. And she was looking at me and she said, "That no, it's not you." And I said, Mam, it is me. And she said, no. And I just pulled down, which I shouldn't have done, but I pulled down there. And I said, Mam, it is me, I promise. And she said, oh, thank God. She said, thank God. And she's gasping and gasping for breath. So
that's so awful because she's so confused in the first place.
So confused. And the nurses were so good because they knew that Mam had Alzheimer's. So she hated being on her own. Again, the fear thing really kicked in. So they'd stop at the window and wave in at her, and some of them would go in and sit with her, which was when they could get time, which was so kind of them, and just talk to her about their day or about, you know, TV, whatever it might be, just to kind of lift her spirits a little bit. And that really did help her that they did that because they knew how anxious she was. And so I had to as well remember that I didn't want Mam to know that something, that she was potentially going to pass away because of this, because I didn't want to scare her anymore because she was already terrified.
Just to branch off slightly here. So as you're talking there, I'm just thinking about this fear thing with Alzheimer's and dementia. So we know dementia is an umbrella term.
Yeah.
And Alzheimer's is one of the, I suppose it's a bit like a spectrum nearly. Dementia is the umbrella. And then from that, you can have all sorts of different, I suppose, conditions.
Yeah.
Alzheimer's is one of them. But in general, when we speak about that and you talk about the fear, I was trying to think about it there as you were talking. And I guess it's because it's almost feel like you're lost. Because you're in your head and you don't know where am I and why am I here and it must be, that's where that, it's terrifying because it's like if you or I were plucked and put into space and you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are, you don't know who this person is or what's happening, like, but you still have the emotion of terror and fear. Is that a good explanation?
That's good explanation of it. So you're kind of like, you're lost in the physical sense, like in the space that you're in, but you're lost within yourself. Because nothing in your head is making sense. And then when you add to that, so you add COVID to it, it just amplifies every single thing. So you're on back and forth. Like, you know, I was getting, they were so good, giving me updates through the night, the whole thing. And then the next day, it was afternoon time. I had been on to them. Nothing had changed, blah, blah, blah. My friend had come over to me. She jumped the balcony to bring me over food because she knew I wasn't eating. She was sitting there and next thing my phone rang and I looked at my phone and it said Mam. And I obviously thought they're ringing me from mom's phone, and I started bawling. And I answered the phone. I said, "Mom, just in case it was her." And she says, "Who the fucking hell did you think it was?" And I was like, "Oh my God, my friend Jade was there at the time." And she was like, "Pam." And she said, "Who's that in the background?" And I said, "It's Jade." "Oh, hi, hello, Jade." You know, and she, and I was like, "What?" So I had a chat with the doctors then after, and I said, "What happened? Like, what's got, you know, what have you done? How, thank you. Like, what have you done?" And they said, "We didn't do anything." Yeah. Obviously, it wasn't her time. She's still very ill. She's still going to be in hospital for a long time, but at the moment she's stable. She's different to the way you saw her yesterday. So she was in rehab then for, I think, about another 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks. And then...
But ultimately she got out of there.
Yeah.
And got back to the
rented accommodation at that stage. Yeah.
Okay. So, and she returned to your dad?
Yes. Now, I have a video of that, and it is because one of the days that I went to see Dad, and he came to the window, and he'd be so excited to see you because, you know, he hadn't seen anyone. He was on his own. Like, they'd never been apart, like, since they'd been married, like, really, you know, maybe a week on if Mom went away with the girls or something, but that would be it. And he was really upset this day. And I said to him, and I actually put my hands under the window and I said, "Dad, what's wrong?" And he said, "Will you just tell me the truth? Is Pam gone?" And I said, "No." I said, "I promise you she's not gone." I said, "She is very sick." I said, "But she's doing well. You know, she's doing well."
And was he confused also at this stage?
He was confused. Yeah, he was confused. But Dad almost... I feel like he brushed the Alzheimer's to the back of his mind, if that makes sense. He was more kind of like, he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to kind of, you know, "Yeah, I have it, grand, okay, I don't want to get into discussions on this." I think Dad's thing was he was just praying that it wouldn't get to a point
where it took over
where him. You know, and took his identity, because that's essentially what Alzheimer's does. It's kind of like you grieve a person over and over because you're meeting a different personality type over and over, because that's what it does. It's, you know, it attacks the brain. You might meet, you know, say Dad, and he's in good form and his speech is good and he can walk and he can do this and he can do that. And then that might change very quickly. And then that's a new baseline. Baseline is a word that's used a lot in, you know, this is the new baseline. I don't know how many times I've heard that. So it's like, it can just change very quickly or it can be very slow. It just depends.
But it doesn't go back?
No.
Okay.
No, generally it doesn't.
Yeah.
I know some people may have other stories.
So there may be a change, but then this is the new.
This is the new normal.
Just a quick one from me. Look, I know Sundays can be really hard when you're grieving. It's that family day, isn't it? When everyone's doing their thing, spending time together, and you're left feeling like something's missing, it's tough. And that's exactly why I'm inviting you to come along to a one-day grief retreat and wellness day on Sunday, April the 27th at the Savoy Hotel in Limerick. This day is all about you. It's a chance to take a break from the heaviness and really focus on yourself for a day. We'll be hearing real stories of loss from people who totally get it, people who've been where you are and can share what's helped them. It's such a powerful way to connect and know that you're not alone. We'll also have some optional seated yoga, journaling, meditation. Don't worry, it's all very laid back. Do as much or as little as you like. It's your day. So you can come on your own, like most people do. Or if you'd rather, bring along your partner, siblings, friends, whoever you feel most comfortable with. The day is designed to make you feel supported no matter how you choose to experience it. If Sundays are hard for you, this is a nice chance to spend the day with others who understand and to just take a little time out to care for yourself. You don't have to go through it alone. Tickets are available now at griefireland.com, and I'd really love for you to join us there.
So your mum gets out, they get reunited. So can you talk to me a little bit about then how she began to progress in terms of, I suppose, did the disease progress significantly where she maybe wouldn't even know who you were?
So it did. She had another setback then when she was in Mount Carmel. She ended up getting this dreadful ulcer on her leg, which was it was horrendous. She was in so much pain with it. She ended up back in James's again. Mm. And I had found the accommodation. This accommodation had stairs. It was the only one I could find. And I was like, do you know what? For us to be together, this is just, we're just going to have to figure this out. If we all have to sleep downstairs, we'll do that. So I went and I collected her at James's to bring her back. Dad got out on the 10th. Mom got out on the 14th of November and went back to the house. She was, at that stage, I'd notice a quietness. She was much quieter in herself. Mm. But you have to remember as well, like, this was all very new. We had been apart for so long, even though we saw each other. Then we're in this house. It's not our own house. Everything's different. Mm. Nothing looks the same. It's all very new. Mom was so desperate to get back home. So that was a real worry for her. And I'd have to, you know, say to her, it's going to be very soon. But at that stage, I didn't know, because our builders that initially were building the house, they went, that franchise of that company, they went bust. So we were left with no builders. Now, our assessor was so good. He had organized builders before he even told me this, because he knew just the stress of the situation. Level. So it actually turned out in the stairs was the making of my mom, because it built up her strength and her ability, because she had lost, she was in a lot of pain with her leg. She was on a walker when she came home. She didn't like using the walker. And we started doing exercises up and down the stairs, just little ones, like two steps at a time, maybe. And then all of a sudden, she was up and down the stairs herself. And that gave her great confidence, you know, because I was like, look what you did. And they said to you that you might never be able to use that leg properly again. Like, look what you did. And then, yeah, I could see a difference.
And what about your dad at that point?
He would go through phases. Dad was very up and down. So like, dad could be sitting there and, you know, they'd be sitting together watching TV. And then he'd say, I'm going to go up and have a shave now. And he'd go up and have a shave and a wash and come down, as mom would say, like a new pin. And then little by little, that kind of, he wouldn't do it as often, say. Stuff like that I noticed, you know, he'd still be able to make a cup of tea, whereas mom wouldn't.
Yeah. So from listening to you, I feel like your mom was the more progressed that needed the more care.
She progressed a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she progressed a lot quicker. She didn't, even if I went to the bathroom, she'd wait outside the bathroom door. Okay. And she'd say to me, and I'd say, I'll be out in 2 seconds. I'm literally just in here. I'll be out in 2 seconds. Okay, I'll just wait here. You know, so she'd wait for me. And
is that fear you speak about?
Yeah. Terrible fear. And she used to say to me, I'm so scared. And I'd say to her, what are you scared of? And she'd say, I don't know. Now, we found out through mom's diagnosis that she had, as had my dad, I won't get into it, but they had both had quite traumatic things happen to them. And this all started to come up again. And I think when Alzheimer's comes into your family, it's like any disease. It's so new. Like, you don't know anything about it. You don't, because it's something you don't want to touch your family. So you're not going to go out and research it. You're like, stay the hell away from me and my people. So when someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I go back to that perception of reality again, I was kind of the one who was always in the wrong, the one who bore the brunt of stuff going wrong. You know,
I can understand that, because you're actually the reality.
Yes.
But you're not her reality.
Yeah.
Because her reality is very different to yours.
Exactly.
Even though it's very real to her.
Yeah.
It's not what we all see.
Yeah.
So if I was viewing the situation, I would see what, I'd be in line with you.
Yeah.
Whereas she had a reality, but it wasn't the one that I see and you see.
So I found that really hard.
Of course.
Because I was like, why am I getting blamed for stuff like where, you know, and stuff being said back to me, and I was really hurt. Like I it hurt so much, because I was like, it couldn't be further from the truth of, you know, what's going on. And it's only, I suppose, when that professor said to me, perception of reality, I actually said, okay, so I need to just realize that although we're living in the same world, we're kind of living in two different worlds. And then I did a course on it, which helped me. It opened up my eyes to happens.
Good on you.
You know?
Yeah. Can I ask, I would imagine the mood changes a lot.
A lot.
Like maybe someone who's very gentle all of a sudden can become very angry and temper.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Temper. It's altering your brain chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's the fear. The fear kicks in. If you, you know, if you feel vulnerable with Alzheimer's, you know, you can get angry because you're sticking up for yourself, you know, on what you think is a situation or what's going on. So there's all this confusion for both sides, because the family member is like, hang on, what's after happening here? I don't understand. And I did, as I say, I struggled with that for a long time until I actually did some research, spoke to a lot of people in America, actually, because there's a lot of help over there, like, and as there is here, don't get me wrong, the Alzheimer's Society are really, really helpful. But I suppose specific situations, people on social media that I'd found were extremely helpful.
It's very prevalent in America, though. I see an awful lot of chat about it.
Yes, it's huge.
You know, obviously, I think my grandmother had a little bit, I don't know, she properly diagnosed, you see, back then.
Yeah.
We used to say she has a bit of dementia, which is so ridiculous. It's like saying you have a bit of cancer.
Yeah.
She obviously just didn't get the proper, maybe she did, maybe I just didn't realise. But even, you know, my sister, as I speak about all the time here, she'd brain cancer. But in the end, she almost presented like someone with Alzheimer's because the cancer was in her brain. So her mood, everything altered.
Yeah.
Her, to the point where she was talking nonsense. You know, I remember going to Beaumont for a shunt and she was like, get my school bag, get it. And it was so real to her. But, oh my God, to be you, to be that person that knows it's not real, but it's real to them, to try and work with them in that situation.
Yeah.
Is so difficult. It's so upsetting. It's so stressful. So you're trying to comfort them, but it's not real. And you almost have to nearly lie to them. Yeah, I'll get it for you in a minute.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't go against them and say, what are you talking about? That's nonsense.
Yeah. And that's the worst. That's, you know, things that like that, that mom would be looking for, you'd have to go and find it. Or she became very obsessed, I suppose, nearly with where some of her relatives were buried in the graveyards, and she was forgetting where they were buried. So this was a huge, big, like, how can I forget this? Like, how can I, like, what's wrong with me? And then I suppose one of the standout moments for me with Mom is, and I'll never forget it, I was just after sitting down on the couch and she came out to me and she said, it was so clear, and the way she put it, like, it was just, it was Mom. In that moment, it was my mom before Alzheimer's, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that you knew and loved all your life, yeah.
She said to me, do I make sense to you? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, do I make sense to you? Simple question. And I said, yeah, you do make sense to me. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. I said, give me an example. Like, what made you think this way? And she said, because what I have up here, she pointed to her head, and what comes out of my mouth are different. And I just thought, wow, that must be so scary to be so aware of that, that she'd no control over it. I said, Mom, you'd want to hear some of the stuff I come out with sometimes. I don't even understand myself. Like, I said, we all have days where we're not 100%. I said, but I understand you. I said, and if there's something that I'm not understanding and you want to talk about it more, we'll talk about it. Because
that's really hard, though, because it almost gives you an insight. Because we can't really understand Alzheimer's because we're not in a person's brain, so we don't know what they're thinking. But it feels like it was almost a glimpse into actual reality there, is that she was trying to tell you, I'm thinking something else, but I'm unable to say it. I want to say it, but it's not what's coming out of my mouth.
What's coming out of my mouth is different.
And that's terrifying.
Horrendous.
Because she's conscious that that's not what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Like, again, it's like that being trapped in your own body. Like, it's such a horrible, horrible feeling. But we'd get great comfort. Like, she started, I suppose it was kind of like role reversal then. She became very, very protective of me, though. So, like, Dad, I laugh at this now because it was funny. Like, these would be the things Dad would do. Like, say I'd be making dinner or something and Dad would come out to the kitchen and he'd go back into Mom and they were just in the room, like, beside the kitchen and say, that fella out there is after telling me this or whatever. And she'd say, what fella? And Dad would say, the fella in the kitchen doing the dinner. And that was me, like, I'm the fella. You learn to have a very thick skin. Mum would get very protective of me and say, that's your daughter that's out there. Don't you be saying that about her, that you don't even recognise her. That's your daughter and blah, blah, blah. You know, she just became very protective of me. And she used to say things to me like, I wish you didn't have to do this. I wish you didn't have to do this. It's not fair. And I'd say to her, Mum, you didn't ask me to do this. I chose to do it because it's what I want to do. Like, I want to spend time with you and Dad. I want to be here. I want to be able to do what I can do. And she said something to me one day and it stuck with me. It really stuck with me. She said, I never wanted to be a burden to you. And I said, and you never have been a burden to me. And I said, never, ever, ever feel that you're a burden to me, because it's not true, because I've been made feel like a burden before, and it's not a nice feeling. It's a horrendous feeling to feel that way. And the fact that my mom even thought for one split second, so we did a pinky promise that day, and I was like, you promise me now that you know you're never, and Dad is never a burden to me. You never asked me to do this. I chose to do it, and it's the best thing I ever did. And it's still the best thing I ever did. I wouldn't change a single part of it. The only part I'd change is that they didn't have to go through what they went through. And what Dad is still going through, that it didn't destroy our family, because that's what Alzheimer's has basically done. It's destroyed our family.
I want to bring you now to, I suppose, a little bit forward in time. Towards October 22, your mum was in the home.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that? In a care home, and she had a stroke.
She had a stroke before she went in.
Okay. Yeah. So she had a stroke and then went back.
Again, she was back in hospital again. Okay. And she got out of hospital and then had another episode. And then after speaking to her team, they had said to me, I said, I'm bringing her home. Like, and they were like, and again, very matter of fact, but very fair in the way they spoke to me about it. And the doctor said to me, you can bring your mom home, but something is going to happen, and that's going to be on your watch. Will you be able to live with that for the rest of your life? And it was very powerful, because we had had near misses where there was one night she slipped in the bathroom, and she didn't even make a noise, but it's just your instinct. I knew something was wrong, and I got up and I was just able to catch her. But if I hadn't caught her, she would have hit the sink, you know. So there's all these things. So I don't mean forced. It made the most sense. Mum used to always say to me, please don't put me away. And what I used to say to her was, I will never put you away until the day that I'm not benefiting or helping you. Because then it becomes dangerous to you, and I'm being selfish by just keeping you, because I want to keep you at home. Because I want my mom, you know, because you always want your mom. So, yeah, she went and she settled in to the care home. She was very anxious at first, you know, and it was, when am I coming home? Because she'd been in so many places at this stage, you know, and then she settled. But by that Christmas, there was a huge change. Dad and I went over Christmas Day. Dad was okay at this stage. His baseline was staying pretty steady. And we went over Christmas Day, and she said to me, why are you giving me presents? And I said, just because we love you, we're giving you presents, you know, not rather than say
stressing her out,
it's saying, Christmas, yeah. Do you know, what's the point if she doesn't just. And she said, you shouldn't be spending your money on me. And but she looked like, you know, she'd love what you'd buy or whatever. And I remember that day we were sitting down, and Dad had got a new kind of walking stick, because his arthritis would have been quite bad at that stage, but it had to be a fancy walking stick. So it was like a shiny metallic blue one. And he was saying to Mum, look, my stick over there. And she wasn't taking in anything he was saying. And then I'd always say, and I have a lovely video of the two of them, and I'd say, do you have any girlfriends, Dad? And he'd say, yeah. And I'd say, who's your girlfriend? And he'd go, Pam. And then I'd say the same thing to Mum, and she'd always say Vinto, because that's what she called him, Vinto. But that started to stop. But they'd still hold hands. And the minute he saw her, he'd say, I love you. You look beautiful. And then she kind of leveled out again going into January of 23. She leveled out a little bit again and she was okay. And then she got a dose kind of coming towards the end of the year. It just wiped her. She lost so much weight. She just became a shadow of what she normally was, of the person she was. At this stage, she had no mobility. She couldn't really speak. She would still say names and she'd ask for me. She would, you know, mention her, say her sister's name as well and her brother's name and people who had passed before. You know, she'd just be calling for them. And then on the 18th of January, I was on my way home from work and I'd always ring. And this particular day, I always went up, but I had a splitting headache this day. And I said, I might just go home. I rang on the way home and I spoke to the nurse and she said to me, she stopped eating. And I said, like, what do you mean? She's like, someone said she stopped eating. It's pretty clear what they mean. But I said, what do you mean? And she said, she's just stopped eating. And then all of a sudden she was talking about palliative care. And I said, hang on, what are you talking about? Like, what's going on? Like, because I'd been in with her the day before. She said, oh, no, we just have to let the palliative care team know that this is but everything's fine. So I said, I'm on my way. So I literally booted it up. And when I got in, the nurse said to me, she said, I'm so sorry if I've upset you. And I was like, no, you're only doing it. I just don't know what to think. Like, what's going on? She said, come on, we'll go into her. And she said, she's still drinking. Like, she's still having her drink. She loved orange. I like anything orangey, like my waddy, anything like that. And, you know, it had to be thickened because what happens is your brain forgets to engage and your swallow starts to go. So we went in and she said, well, give her a drink. And Mom started to pocket the drink in her mouth, which means she just held on to all of it. And I just remember looking at the nurse going, what does that mean? Like, will it come back? Like, what's going on? I was just so stunned by the whole thing. And then the CNM came around to me and she said, look, she's doing okay. Like, we just have to let palliative care know that this is what's going on. But like, she's doing fine. Her vitals are fine. So it was a Thursday. That was about 5:45. By about 8 o'clock, she was on palliative care. And she had a really, really hard couple of days, full of fear. And she was kind of in and out of consciousness. And, you know, I suppose the bad things that had happened, they say before you pass, you have to put right the good and the bad. This is what one of the Reiki ladies in the care home told me. I suppose the trauma part came back to her, which was horrendous to see because she had spoken openly to me about it. So I knew the impact it had had on her. So it's very hard to see someone so distressed, you know, so distressed. But then she started like chatting to her mom, my nana, saying hi, mommy, and hi, daddy. And, she was chatting away to people. But it felt like she just didn't want to. It's making the decision as to whether you go or whether you stay, you know. And I know a lot of it was she didn't want to go. Probably a lot of that was because of me, because she was like, you know, I don't want to. And her family. But in the end, she, on the Sunday, the nurses had said to me, look, we'll probably get, and they're still amazing. Like, they're just, they mind me like a baby over there. One of the nurses, Bernie, came in to me on the Sunday morning and she said, Nicola, will you please go home and go to bed? And I said, no. I said, I don't want to leave. Like, I just don't want to go. And she said, I promise you. She said, I'm going to sit here for the whole time you're gone. Even if it's just an hour, just put your head on the pillow for a while. And she said, I'll be here and I'll read her magazines. So I went home.
And was your dad at home at this stage?
No, he was in the care home.
So he was in the care home.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He went in February 23. Okay. So
you went home.
Yeah. I went home and I put my head on the pillow and I literally fell asleep like that, which I didn't think. I went into a really deep sleep and went into a really vivid dream. And in the dream, Mom was her old self and she was wearing this beautiful white long chiffon dress with these massive big watercolour flower prints all over it, and we were in a field and I could see like the tan on her back and everything. It was a gorgeous day. And she was laughing. She had a real hearty laugh and she was laughing her head off. But I kept saying, there was a train on the dress and I kept trying to catch the train, but I couldn't catch it. It kept slipping out of my hand. And I was like, "Ma'am, wait." And she was like, no, she wasn't laughing at me. She was just laughing at having the bit of crack or whatever. But I bolt upright in the bed. I was like, I have to get back over. So as I was driving in, they phoned me to say, I was like, "Bernie, I'm just outside. I'm just outside." She was like, "Don't panic. I was just ringing to tell you that I'd moved her." But I knew something else had happened. And when we got down, she said, "Look, I had to up the morphine." And I said, "Okay." And she said, that's when she said to me, "I think we'll probably get maybe to Wednesday." And I said, "No." I said, "It's going to be today." And she said, "Do you really think so?" And I told her about the dream. Like I said, I think she's trying to give me the heads up, like that she's ready to go. Like I said, I really do. And that was about 11:30. And she passed in my arms at 2:15. As I was singing to her. Yeah. And some of my cousins were there as well. So in the end, it was peaceful. You know, she was ready to go. Her body was just so worn out. She was so worn out. She'd done so much fighting, like, and she was such a fighter. But I think after you say, you know, and after her sister had said to her, "It's okay. You know, you can head. You're all right. Go to your mom and dad," you know. So yeah, she left that day and nothing has ever been the same since. I didn't tell Dad because what was the point of upsetting someone who already is going through his own battle? That was one of the hardest things, not being able to talk to him and still not really being able, we've never had a proper conversation about it. He talks about her. As in, he'll say her name because his speech isn't great now. But not being able to have him at the funeral was one of the hardest things. But I felt like it was kind of protecting his grief a little bit. But that particular day, the day Mom passed, he kept asking about her. Everyone, "Where is she? Where is she? Where is she?" And kept blessing himself. Like, they were so connected. One of the nurses had brought him down to see her. This was probably like a month or two beforehand. And she said to him, "Do you know who this is?" And he said, "No." And he said, "But she's so beautiful." And she said, This is Pam. This is your wife, Pam." And he said, "Oh, Pam." He said, "I love her." And then he started telling the nurse that she'd been in hospital. So he was going back to when she'd been in hospital or whatever. But he always told her, "You look beautiful." He called her Henno because her maiden name was Hennessy. So Henno and Vinto. But he just, from that day, he just got worse. And he's just deteriorated and deteriorated since Mom left. And it's like a bit of me feels like he wants to go. You know, I'd say he's ready to go because he misses a soulmate. You know, even though he doesn't really understand what's happened, he knows deep down in his core, I think he knows that she's, you know, when he remembers or when he calls her, I still believe that he knows something has happened. So he's now in latter stages. He's doing well. He still has a great appetite. He can't really talk, as I say, anymore. The odd time you get something out of him, like he'll whisper, if I say, you know, I tell him so many times, "I love you," as I did with Mom, and he'll whisper, "I love you," back, you know. But he's just the man. What it does, it just takes the person in such a, it takes everything from them. Do you know, it just takes the way they looked, the way they sounded, everything. It just strips them of everything. And it's just such a cruel, cruel disease and a battle. Because it's such a battle, because you're going through so many different stages. I mean, for the person, you know, there's so many different stages they have to go through. And, you know, with Mom, that fear was just, it was so horrendous to watch. And I have photographs at home of her. She'd sit down and she'd lie beside me and I'd put my arm around her and she'd just go asleep on me. So it was like the way, like, it, again, role reversal. That was her comfort. But yeah, it's just been, it's just destroyed us.
It's really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I feel like, you know, what you're saying, it's like it slowly breaks down a person's character.
Yeah.
Their spirit. Yeah. Your personality.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything that you once were and all the little quirks that makes a person's personality. You know, when we say they have a great personality or they're a great cracker. It's like it's block by block, probably day by day.
Yeah.
Steals a part of it until they become a shell.
Yeah.
Of their former self, and they're not who they once were, which is very, 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 very cruel. That's the word that's used a lot around it. It's a bit like MND in that even though the person's conscious, but it's stripping the person daily. Is there anything crueler for a family member to go through, to watch someone be stripped day by day? I don't know. I think it's just the long-term stress of that. Like, I'd love to just even talk to you about you, because you spoke very much about your mum and dad. But, like, the love that you showed, like, it's unconditional, obviously. It wasn't a question you were going to do care for them. But it's so, so sad and so, it's just upsetting to hear, you know, that one person and one family can grow up so close and so in love with each other to get to this point where you've lost everything.
Yeah.
And you still have your dad, but you don't at the same time because he's not there.
And it's that as well. It's the anticipatory grief as well.
It's hard.
You know, it's, I find that really, because they're both in the same care home. And there's that, you know, you're always waiting for that phone call, you know.
How are you on a day-to-day basis?
Up and down. Yeah, up and down. I am struggling. Like, I miss my mum. I actually can't even put it into words how much I miss her. I find it harder now. You know, we're 14 months on nearly now, and I'm finding it harder now. I still haven't emptied her boxes because I don't want her smell to go. You know, I go to, there's just things that she'd know what to say, you know, if I wanted to go to her and just talk to her. Like, no one could do it like mom, you know, as in, I just want my mom. That's the way I feel. I just want and I need my mom. And it's the one thing I can't have, you know. And I'd love to have dad there too, that we could talk about her, you know, and talk about funny things that happened or just, but I can't do that. I've nobody to do that with, being the only child, like, you know, stuff that would have, when we'd be messing with mom and stuff like that, just silly things, you memories. Know, about growing up memories. Yeah.
You can't share them with anyone.
Like, I can share them with the people closest to me, but they weren't there.
Yeah, exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Whereas dad was there and he got it, and, you know, and just stuff that she used to, like, she could be so funny. Like, her, she had a laugh where if once mom started laughing, that was it. Like, she was gone. Okay. She was gone. And she'd be on the floor. Like, she had an infectious laugh. And to hear that laugh, and I've loads of, you know, videos on my phone. She became a fan of Dr. Dre.
Okay, that's very random. I did not think you were going to say that.
I was doing something in the kitchen some day, and I had whatever on, and Dr. Dre came on, and she came in and she just started to do this dance. Like, so this was a thing where, and she didn't like the language in it.
Of course.
Yeah, no, she didn't like that. But she's just great crack. Like, she just would come out with some absolute crackers of funny things, as did my dad. They're just such brilliant personalities. But I think one of the loveliest parts of it was seeing them fall in love again. As I said before, dad became very protective of mom. And, like, sometimes, you know, I just sneak in, just have a little look around the sitting room door, and they'd just be sitting there holding hands, you know, just happy in each, being in each other's company. The comfort was each other, you know. They just had this deep bond.
Seems like that kind of transcended all disease.
Yeah.
An illness.
It did. It never left them. It
reminded me of the Notebook.
So many people say that. It actually, yeah, very, very similar. Yeah. It was lovely to see.
Like the love never died. No matter what, Alzheimer's and dementia took from them both.
They never let it take it away.
Yeah. Love is deeper than that.
Yeah. Which is, I love thinking about that. And I love when I, you know, I have some, when we moved back to the house, I got the priest to kind of do a little vow renewal for them. And
gorgeous, Nicola.
There's a photo of the two of them in our hallway, like, and they're both like, dad's in his pink shirt and mama's in like her, like, it's like a green flowery dress with pink flowers on it because they were matching. And just the way they look at each other, like, it's just pure love. It's just incredible. And I'm just, do you know what? I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud that they were my parents. I just wish I could have stopped all of this because I'd love to see them get to enjoy their latter years rather than this curse been put on them. Because they were, you know, everyone says it about, but they were just really good, kind people. Like, the one word that was used about my mum throughout when she passed was that she was a lady and she'd never pass you without having a chat. And that's what she was. Like, she was. Now, she had her moments, but we all have our moments. But that's what she was. She was just a lady, you know, and she would do anything for anyone. And she worried about everyone, you know, and she was always very, she felt guilty that she didn't have illnesses. You know, it's not fair that someone else has, and then she gets, but then it comes tenfold at her.
I guess you just never know what's around the corner, do you?
No.
So your dad is still with you?
Yes. Yeah, he is.
Is he struggling a little bit at the moment?
He's lost since Christmas. He's lost complete mobility.
And how is that for you, watching that?
I've only allowed myself to actually say it out loud in the last couple of weeks. One of the men in his unit passed away, and I think that really just made me realise from Jan to March is a time in care homes that there's a lot of people passing away. And I suppose I just, yeah, only allowed myself to think about the fact that, okay, he's not mobile. He's going, he's going the same way Mam went. Now, obviously, they're, you know, they have different, Dad has Alzheimer's, standalone Alzheimer's, not that it makes much difference, and Mam had vascular and Alzheimer's. But I just hope that he's given a free card on a nice passing when it does happen, because I just didn't think that, you know, death could be so cruel, or coming to end of life could be so cruel. I suppose, again, I was a bit naive to it because I had blinkers on and I didn't want to think about it. But he's very well loved. They call him Pappy over there. He can be so funny sometimes. His thing is Jaffa Cakes. So he has...
The shared love of the orange there. Yeah. She's my buddy and he's Jaffa Cakes.
Yeah, yeah.
Orange was their thing.
Their thing and ice cream. But he goes to Jaffa Cakes like it's crack cocaine. Like, it's just, I have to keep the stash.
I wouldn't be too far away from him knowing myself.
They see me coming in with the boxes of Jaffa Cakes. Aww. He just loves them. Jaffa Cakes and milk.
Gorgeous.
But he's so different. You know, he was this big, strong, not a big, strong man, but very fit man, you know. To see him now, you know, and people say to me, oh, he looks really well. I see a different person now.
Of course you do, yeah.
So they might look okay from the outside, but on the inside, another person. On the inside, they're not themselves, you know, they're not.
Just one or two things before I let you go. Do you worry, I suppose, I don't know the ins and outs of both diseases, but is it hereditary?
So there's different, people will have different thoughts on this. Mm. I've been told by professionals that it's not hereditary. Mm. And that basically what I was told was I have as much chance of getting it, this person said, as you do.
Okay.
And because mom and dads were different as well, it takes a percentage down. Is it something I worry about? I don't let myself think about it because, to be honest with you, and this might sound, I said this to my friends and they were like, don't be saying that. And I was like, no, like Alzheimer's has destroyed our family. I would never let myself live with Alzheimer's. I'd be going to Dignitas or I would be doing something because I honestly couldn't, not the three of us, no. So it's not something that I ever want, it's not something I ever want to live with, but I wouldn't, if they said to me, this is what you have, I would be, and that probably sounds very dramatic to people, but when you have a family that's wiped out by one disease and you've seen everything that they've gone through and the torture and pain that they've been through, no.
Mm.
I don't want
yeah.
It.
You know, I think you're just a phenomenal person.
Thank you. I don't feel phenomenal, but thank you. But
hold on, like, it's really important to me to tell you. You are. Like, you really are. I think there's too much focus on, you know, what makes a great person. Oh, someone who has a load of followers or someone who created whatever. Like, of course, each their own. And
yeah.
But to me personally, it's sitting in front of you. You, to me, are phenomenal. And we spent a lot of this chat talking about your mum and dad because I wanted to and I wanted to hear. But all the time I was looking at you going, oh my God. Like, just the kindness of you to take care of them. But of course, I mean, I would do the same thing myself. A lot of people wouldn't. I've heard in hospitals when I used to go into my sister and care for her, and the nurses would say, not everyone. And I'd say, well, sure, of course, we're coming in to look after. And she said, there are people here who have family members who don't come in. So I would hope that you would find it in yourself to be kind to yourself, to know that you're more than a good person. I'm also a parent. And for a long time, we only had one boy and we've been very blessed to have another child, but he was the only child for 6 years.
Yeah.
And like, just to think what you did for your mom and dad, like that love between a parent and a child, but the child, it's an equal relationship. Like the way a parent loves a child,
yeah.
The way the child loves the parent back. It's just, it's a powerful thing.
Yeah,
that love.
It is.
Because it works both ways, but the love, yeah. You know, it's not all the parent being adoring the child. The child adores the parent yeah. too. And I just think that I really, really hope that you know that as a human, you're phenomenal. You really are. Like,
thank
you've
you.
Given back so much and you've done so much and you've cared so much. And not everyone does that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I feel like it was a privilege, to be honest. I feel like I was very lucky to get to do it. I really do, because I just think we got to have so much special time together that we wouldn't have, because sometimes in life you let things take over you, and you know, and it's about getting to the top of the corporate ladder and, you know, this is important and blah, blah, blah. And you know what? At the end of the day, when your time comes, no one's going to say, oh, she was a great worker. Not that I want people to be saying she was good, but like, why not spend the time with the people you love? Like, you know, and I wouldn't change a bit of it. It was tough going.
Oh, yeah.
But it was.
That's what I mean. It was more than tough going. It was horrendous.
But
that journey you've been on is horrendous.
Yeah.
But I just really hope that you're grieving. You're still anticipating another grief. You're living in a grief of not having your dad be well enough to understand and know what's going on. Like, you're carrying so much. You're carrying the weight of knowing that your mum is gone, but he doesn't really know. And like, all the unspoken stuff, like, and I hope that you have a good support system around you.
I do.
I really hope that you can. I hope that you can know that you did everything that you possibly could and you left no stone unturned. And that I really, really hope that you can enjoy the rest of your life and find happiness and peace, because you're still in the thick of it.
Yeah.
Your mum has only gone 14 months. Mm. Like, you're still in the thick of it. But my hope for you is that in time that you can find a lot of happiness and peace in your life. You're a good person.
Thank you. I really hope so too. Yeah. That's what hope is around the corner.
Thank you, Nicola, for coming in and for speaking about this. It's been something I've wanted to talk about for a long time. You know, a lot of people write into me about that. Alzheimer's, dementia. So I really appreciate you taking the time to travel down here and to share the story of your mum and dad.
No problem. I talk about them anytime. So, yeah, exactly. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.